Over the years, Britain developed into one of the world's major centers of film and television industries. And behind all great movies that have been produced over the years, there are many men and women who made it all come together, and their stories are an important part of the history. Welcome to another episode of the Humming Projector podcast, where we today will talk about the British Entertainment History Project, who seeks out to document and preserve this history while key players are still with us. The guest who will join me today has a name you probably will recognize, as she also joined me in the previous episode. Sue Malden is an independent media archive management consultant and formerly the head of the BBC Broadcast Archives. Welcome to the podcast, Sue. It is great to have you back here in this episode.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be talking to you again. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, when we spoke last time, I realized we really had another episode of a different subject. But let's do a short recap, because the previous episode we talked about Film is Fabulous, and you were having an event now in May. So before we start about talking about today's subject, how did the Film is Fabulous event turn out?
Well, it was fantastic. It took place on the 11th of May in the Phoenix Arts Centre in Leicester, where the first event we ever had was launched there. So it was nice to be back and reliving the start and appreciating just how much we particularly had achieved in the sort of about 18 months in between. So there must have been about 100 or so people there, mainly film collectors, I think, and people who cared and were interested in film. There were some great finds that were shown, which I think we talked about last time. In particular, Paul Venesis, who helps us a lot with technical requirements and upgrading copies that get found, he made a brilliant compilation of extracts from three episodes of The Third Man that John Franklin, our main organiser, had selected them. And they were... they were brilliant. They were so exciting. I really wanted to watch the whole thing. So, I hope I'll be able to see all three of them at some time. And as I said before, they're particularly significant to me because at one time, the Third Man series was held in the BBC archive, and we're still actually trying to track down what happened to the many episodes that were there. I think at the moment, I said there's about 6 to 10 on YouTube, and these three that have been found. But I mean, it was a series that ran for some time. We had hoped at that event we'd have been able to announce that Film is Fabulous had received charitable trust status, but we haven't heard yet. And I think we were being a little optimistic to expect to get the news that quickly. But we did inform the audience that that's what we're looking for. That's what we hope. And generally, we just talked about the future. When that happens, we'll be able to be far more proactive in fundraising. And quite frankly, funds are absolutely essential to keep any project like this going.
Oh, yeah.
So
for sure.
We're optimistic about the future, hoping for charitable trust status fairly soon, and then to begin real proper fundraising and accepting donations and appealing to different funds. So that sounds like, we hope, a pretty optimistic future.
Yeah, it sounds like you had a really great time, and I'm glad to hear that, and I hope to hear more about that work in the future.
Oh, yes.
But you are having many hats, like we would say in Norway. You have many roles in different projects. And today we're talking about something else you are doing. We'll talk about the British Entertainment History Project.
Yeah.
What is actually the British Entertainment History Project? Could you explain a little bit about what it's all about?
Yes, certainly. It was originally known as the BEC2 History Project. And BEC2 was the craft union for people working in film and television. Initially, the union had been known as the ACT, and then the ACTT. And then there was a merge between that union and the ABS, which had been a union that represented people in the BBC. And those two unions merged and became BEC2. which was the British Entertainment Craft Trade Union. So BEGTU is and was supported by the union. They have always given us rooms to have our meetings in and maybe do recordings. They make a regular annual donation, which is very much appreciated, and help us in the past with some of the administrations. So we were very pleased to be associated with BEGTU, but we did realise that that close association with the union meant that many people actually thought you had to be a union member to be part of the history project, and also right. that all our recordings were actually just about trade union activity. And of course, they're not. People talk about their careers, how they got started, etc. So it was much, much broader than their union activity. And some of them weren't even particularly active in the union. So we decided that that was a slightly misleading name. So we renamed the project the British Entertainment History Project to make it obvious that it was broader than just trade union activities. Although we say British, it is largely British, but of course, people have worked in the States. A lot of people in the early days of the film industry came from Eastern Europe. So we're not exclusively British, and we certainly wouldn't exclude anybody else of any other nationality who'd worked in film and television and radio and theatre. We include those four genres because many people cross from one to another. Currently, a lot of people who start in radio maybe end up working in television. People in television have often migrated into film. Back in the 50s, late 50s, a lot of people moved from film to television in the McCarthy age era. And also directors and actors work in the theatre, on the stage, but also in television and film. So we try and cover all four aspects of entertainment in that way.
So which decade do we talk about now? Which year was it formed?
Oh, okay. Well, it was started by two people. In particular, the founder was a guy called Roy Fowler, and he was talking to trade union members, admittedly, and they were regretting the fact that one of their colleagues had recently died. And they said, oh, that's dreadful, because he knew all about the production of blah, blah, or what it was like at Shepperton Studios. And so between them, Roy took the lead, and they decided to start interviewing their colleagues. And this began in 1987. We have their paper archive, and Roy was incredibly well organized. He wrote millions of letters appealing for funds from well-known film producer directors and companies and things like that. He did a lot to celebrate the centenary of film back in 1990s. So I can't remember the exact date, but early 1990s. He was very well supported by someone called Alan Lawson, who helped a lot with the interviews. But we also noticed that people like Kevin Brownlow, the well-known film historian, among other things, he was involved in the early days, as was Stephen Peat, who made a lot of wonderful television programmes for the BBC, particularly with a kind of like an oral history theme to them. He'd look back at the education or what had happened in a particular village or things like that and interview a lot of people with their memories. So obviously oral history was very close to his heart, and he played a big part in the early days of the history project. So it was 1987 that they started. They recorded on audio only. If you think back to 1987, they used Sony Walkman cassettes, which I think had been donated to the collection. And most young people these days don't know what on earth a Sony Walkman is, or a cassette. So we immediately, as we slightly younger people became involved, we immediately hit certain problems and issues with the collection that were not a criticism at all of the originators, but a reflection of the change in technology over a very relatively short period of time. So the other thing to stress is, on the whole, they were recording colleagues or people they'd worked with, people they knew. And I have to say, by and large, they were all men, relatively middle class and white.
Yeah.
So they were a bit selective in the people they interviewed. And of course, to some extent, that reflected both the television and the film industry, well, and theatre and radio as well. So they, you know, one can't be critical of them, but it is an observation that we have tried since then to redress the balance, if possible, and to reflect more accurately the makeup of the industries now.
Yeah.
And we could say, if we're honest, back in the 50s, they were definitely reflecting the makeup of the industry in the 50s. So, you know.
So how long have you been involved in the project? When did you start?
Well, I started in about 2000. I retired from the BBC in October 2000, I think. And a very close friend of mine was a film historian, documentary maker called Jerry Keel, who was a great supporter and a great friend. And I think he thought, you know, that on Monday morning after you've stopped running the BBC archives, what are you going to do? So he took me along to a Bechtu History Project meeting. And that was it. So that was in about 2001, I think. I think a lot of the early people enjoyed the company. They enjoyed meeting old colleagues. They enjoyed talking about projects they'd worked on, people they knew, and things like that. And the end of the meeting, well, I should spool back a little bit. I unfortunately was late arriving for one meeting when they were having elections. And they obviously thought, oh, the little girl, she'd make a good secretary. And before I knew where I was, I'd been elected secretary. I arrived 5 minutes later to be congratulated. So what I was going to say before that was, when I was minuting these meetings, the highlight, this sounds dreadful, but the highlight of the meetings was the last item, which was called obituaries, when they all talked at length about people who had died and how, what a shame it was they hadn't got round to interviewing them. And if only they talked to them, and only that, and only that. And then they would go on to, and of course, then there's Joe Bloggs. He knew a lot about it as well. And what about John Smith? I saw him, you know. So I started writing down all these names they came out with. So because prior to that, they just talked and nothing happened. So I wrote down all the names and sort of like a schoolmistress made them start interviewing these these people that they'd mentioned. And so that built, now it's like a stick to beat us with now. It's a very long list. We continue to allow people to volunteer and suggest people to be interviewed, and they go on the list. But also there's an awful lot of happenstance, really. You meet someone and think, oh, we ought to interview him for the project. Or someone else will say, oh, I was talking to Mrs. So-and-so the other day. You really ought to interview her. She knew an awful lot about makeup and stuff like that. And so one of the things I did was, I've been associated with Doctor Who television series for quite a long time, and I know there's a big fandom there. So I asked the fans to let me know everybody who they knew had ever worked on Doctor Who. And then I checked to see whether we had interviews with any of these people. Quite a few we did, like Waris Hussein was one of the directors, more than I can think of, which maybe I could talk about it on another time. And I then asked the fans, if you had the chance to interview someone now, who would you choose? So they came forward with more names. So some Someone recently interviewed June Hudson for us, who was makeup and costume, did a lot on Doctor Who, and recently actually appeared in a Doctor Who episode as well. So we got a great interview with her. I think she's nearly 80 and still incredibly active and articulate and things. So our list sometimes doesn't seem to get any shorter because we keep getting distracted by interviewing people that we come across and we think would be good to interview. On a slightly more serious note, we're always trying to redress the balance. As I said earlier, we're conscious that many of the people we have in the archive are men of a certain class and what have you. So we're always at pains to try and get more women interviews. So we've worked with some of the universities and academics such as Melanie Bell, Vicky Ball, Lorraine Porter, who have been doing academic projects on women who've worked in film and television. And so we've collaborated in the past and picked up some of their interviews for for our archive, or have gone out and interviewed people that would be useful for them in their projects. Mm. We're very conscious that we don't represent the disabled community very well. And it was wonderful for me at Film is Fabulous, I met Chris Ball, who works a lot with the disabled community and has offered to help us by interviewing people. So again, that's going to help give them more exposure, have role models for younger people coming along and so on, and enhance the collection as well.
And as I understand, the diversity is not just about men and women and age and color, but you are also interested in a broad range of different trades, like not only actors and directors, but also the working men and women, like editors, cameramen, and audio recorders. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. Exactly as you said at the very beginning, by and large, most of the people we have interviewed and are interviewing now are the people behind the scenes, as you said, cameras, lighting, editing, directing, DOP, makeup, costumes, all the crafts, really. It's absolutely important to get them all represented. We recently interviewed Debbie Wiseman, who's a UK-based composer who has written an awful lot of wonderful music for films. And so we've got musicians there. There are the odd actor and music performer, but it's very much trying to represent all the crafts. Mm. So one thing we're a bit conscious of, as I think you said earlier, about special effects and how special effects have changed dramatically over the years. And we have interviews with quite a few special effects guys, but we need to try and make sure that area in particular we keep up to date and learn more about the technology and digital technology and how that supports them, as well as the impact it will have or is having on camera operators and picture editors as well.
Yes, and why do you choose to focus on the different trades? Is it just because you want to capture the history and what happened on the film set, or do you think it will help us understand more of the films themselves by listening to their stories?
Very good question. I suppose, to be honest, we inherited the principles behind the project from the founders, particularly Roy Fowler, and it came from that conversation of realizing that such a lot of knowledge and information was getting lost and not recorded anywhere, which has several functions. One, I mean, it's great to celebrate the history of an industry or the history of how a particular film was made and so on. But it's also important for people to learn from the way these people worked. One thing in particular to think about is the social conditions at the time that they also reflect in their conversations, you know, how difficult it was for women to work in the laboratories, for example. They had a dreadful time getting locked in dark rooms and things like that.
Yeah.
Which hopefully wouldn't happen now, but, you know, you never know.
Yeah.
And so there is a lot of reflecting social history there. Mm. People, you know, we have a cameraman. This isn't social history, but we have a cameraman who went over the trenches of the First World War in one of those balloons, filming all the devastation that was there. And him talking about what it was like doing that, how heavy was his camera, how was stuff recorded? You know, I mean, an amazing experience that he did that, and to hear him talking about it. Another sort of almost reflecting history is there's a film called Let My People Go. And it was written and produced by John Krish, who we have an interview with. The cameraman was Walter Lassily. It was sponsored by Lindsay Anderson. And I managed to get a copy of this film from Contemporary Films, who are the distributors. It's not very long. And I watched it, and there were no credits on the end. And I thought, oh, he sent me the wrong version. So I phoned up and said, I think you sent me the wrong version here. There's no credits on the end. And he said, oh, for that film, there weren't any credits because it was very critical of apartheid in South Africa. And anybody involved in it was worried about retribution.
Right.
Should their names be associated with it? Well, you know, that's a really important piece of history to know that people were affected like that, but still cared enough about the issue of the time to make the film. We value the collection, as I said, first of all, to celebrate the industry. Also, it's marking so much social change and events that happened that were covered by newsreel cameramen. It's potentially useful for educational purposes.
Mm.
And it's great nostalgia for people. A lot of people just love listening to the interviews.
Yes.
I was talking on the telephone the other day to a lady called Penny Emmett, I think, who was a financial secretary for David Lean when making Lawrence of Arabia. And she was amazing in talking about what it was like when they were doing the Aqaba sequence, how they were fenced in, protected by soldiers. They had nothing to do apart from talk to one another about what did they know and what did they not know, you know.
Hmm.
But what an experience, someone talking like that. So I now need to find out, have we got anybody else talking about Lawrence of Arabia and Lean in particular, and see if we can build a little history project there. It's the sort of stuff that, you know, master's students or PhD students could make wonderful stories, wonderful history out of the collection.
Who are the ones performing the interviews these days? You mentioned that in the early days there were people interviewing their own mates, but today, what kind of people are working for the project now?
We're much less selective, I suppose, in that sense. Usually people come forward and say, I'm really interested in so-and-so. I'd love to go and interview them. So there's someone called Martin Sheffield. He does a lot of interviewing. He used to work at the BFI, so he has a lot of contacts. I've interviewed a few people, particularly those in the archive world. But also I come from a little town called Hereford in England, and someone there told me that Bruce Robinson, the amazing film director and writer of screenwriter of Killing Fields and Withnail and I, that he happened to live somewhere in Herefordshire. So I went looking for him to interview. Mike, our chair, Mike Dick, he does quite a few interviews. He's interviewed Maddie Smith recently. So it's by and large, it's members of the group that interview people they come across or they know of. Recently, we've been helping the BBC in a small way to celebrate its centenary. So the year before, was the centenary of BBC broadcasting beginning in Manchester.
Mm.
So we put on an event there to promote the history project. And then we also encourage people to come forward and help us doing interviews or offering themselves to be interviewed. We did a similar thing at the end of last year in BBC Plymouth, which began radio broadcasting 100 years earlier. We did the same thing, a big demonstration of what we've got, what we can do. And then we've picked up about half a dozen people who were significant in television making in BBC Plymouth, and we'll be interviewing them over the next coming months.
Mm.
So really, it's by and large, it's people in the project, but then sometimes if there are other people we know who know a lot and would be good to interview a particular person because of their knowledge of the subject, then we will ask them to volunteer as well. So on that note, I'd love to make an appeal for anyone who'd like to contact us and offer either to be interviewed or name someone they think should be interviewed or actually do the interviewing. We have guidelines and everything for people to stick to. Generally, the answer is you have to ask certain basic questions like, you know, education, how did you get into the industry? Mm. What did your parents do? Is that the way you got in? You know, and then once you've done that, the instructions say, just let them talk about whatever experiences they've had. What films have they worked on? What equipment have they used? Who've they worked with? Anything like that. People, if you relax, create a sufficiently relaxed environment, people will love just talking. As an interviewer, maybe I've been going on too much already. as an interviewer, you don't have to worry too much about the questions.
I looked through some of the interviews you have in the project, and I listened to the interview number 679 with David Prowse, who acted as Darth Vader. And my favorite there was at 29 minutes, if you look it up, he talked about how it came to be that James Earl Jones ended up doing the audio for Darth Vader and not him. So that was my favorite of the recording.
Oh,
what
brilliant.
Is your favorite of all the recordings you have listened to?
Oh, wow, that's difficult. I don't know. Perhaps one of my favorite interviews is with a feature film director called Chris Challis, who made Those Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machines. And he describes what it was like being in an aircraft flying over occupied Belgium. Mm. And they'd had information that the Germans had left the area. And so they were flying over with food packages and things like that to be dropped for the Belgians. And they landed. And some people came running out of the bushes and said to them, what on earth are you doing here? The Germans are still here. You've got to get going again. So they took off and flew off at a frantic pace. And I imagine he used some of that experience in Those Magnificent Men in Their Flying Machines. So it was nice.
Good. Let's talk a little bit about the database itself. How many interviews do you have in the database at the present?
It really started from when Mike Dick became chair, and Elaine Burrows, who used to work at the BFI cataloguing department, and me, but particularly led by Mike, we wanted to make the collection much more accessible, and we wanted people to be able to find it and use it and listen to it. So a database was absolutely essential. So this is probably about 10-12 years ago. We had some volunteers who helped us build the database, which was absolutely fantastic. People from a small company called Redport, and it's a Drupal base. Elaine and I came up with all the sort of fields and things that we wanted to be able to search. We consulted with the union on the different crafts. We also looked at what FIAF, the Film International Archive professional grouping, what categories they had of jobs within the film industry, and tried to use those as much as we could. But of course, we had to keep it relatively simple, and we didn't. It couldn't be too expensive. And now it's been running for well over 10 years, 12 years. We can see the faults in it. We would love to be able to make it simpler for people to search. But that's going to require money. And yeah. So is our more deep-seated problem, that this is a Drupal database that I think we're on Drupal 7. Mm. And Drupal are now on 10. And withdrew any official support for Drupal lower than 10 back in January this year. So that's really quite frightening for us. And we do need to migrate the database. Possibly we're thinking that WordPress is more commonly used and maybe simpler to use. So we're looking to find sources of funding to enable us to upgrade the database and to some extent the website to make it more intuitive in the way that you search it. We use it a lot, so we know how it works, but that's not necessarily so easy for anybody else. So we do want to make the searching easier and simpler. But of course, in order to do that, we have to have all the interviews transcribed. As I said, even we working with the project, we'd find an interview, listen to it, having had no idea who the person was and what they did, and then be astounded at what we learned, what they were involved with. So really, to be able to search the text is really essential. So for some, we've had support and help from academics in the past who've managed to get arts and humanities funding to transcribe some of the interviews. We've had help from a company called Speechmatics, and currently we're using something called Otter AI. Now we have at the moment, I think it's about 820 interviews. So that's an awful lot to get digitized. We have in fact digitized all of them, all the audio on those old Sony U-matic cassettes, all the video. We switched to video about 6-7 years ago, I think, recording on DV cams and any kind of professional small video formats we could use. And then for the last probably at least 2 or 3 years, the cameramen have been shooting on camera cards. So all the content is digital. We are nearly at the end of reviewing the quality of the digitization on the hard drive. So our plan is to store on solid state hard drive and then duplicate that or triplicate it. So we've got several copies of it safely stowed away in different buildings.
Oh, yes. Make sure you have backups.
At the moment, we're transferring from all the individual hard drives that we had to the master one. And in that process, Mike has been checking the quality of the digitization. And where necessary, we're getting them re-digitized. Because on the whole, the original interviews are of a high standard. That occasionally there'll be a fridge humming in the background or something like that, but very rarely, on the whole, they're very good. So some of the issues have been perhaps with the digitization. So we've found about 30 interviews that need to be redone. But once that's completed, and again, another volunteer is helping us to do that, everything will have been digitized. And then we address the issue of transcripts. And so we're looking to introduce a sort of system of managing how many have we got transcripts for? Do they have time code in them? Are they the standard that we want? And then Mike will put the interview through Otter AI, having already got it digitized, and that now produces a pretty good speech-to-text transcript. So all we need now is volunteers to proofread these transcripts and correct them, and then we can upload the corrected transcript. So I'm working on a spreadsheet to manage all of that at the moment. And then once we've done that, you know, we've got it really into a pretty good state. Other things we always wanted was a still image of each of the interviewees, which we have now got. We also want a short biography of each of the interviewees to be a quick way into the interview. So we welcome volunteers to help with that, volunteers to help us find photos where we haven't got them yet. And all of that, together with the transcripts, we think will make the collection much more searchable, discoverable, really. But it's a lot to do with volunteers.
Sure. So who are the main consumers of the database? Who uses it the most? Are there researchers, fans? Who are the main consumers?
Well, they're all equally weighted, I would say. A lot of academics use the interviews to teach their students or to work on a research project. They will, a bit as I was saying about Melanie Bell and the other ladies, getting arts and humanities funding to support their research activities that then generate maybe interviews that we look after or transcribe some of the interviews that we have. So there's very much a strong academic interest. We license a certain amount at a relatively low rate to film distributors. So there are a few companies who are remastering and distributing new movies or negotiating the rights for the movies, and they're on Blu-ray, and they quite like to have some extras to go with it. So a company called Powerhouse uses a lot of our interviews in as extracts on their film distribution. Sometimes television and radio want to use our interviews, you know, particularly Radio 4's obituary series, a bit depressing, but they've used our interviews on occasions. Anybody making a program, a profile of anyone, like Michael Bond, who created Paddington Bear, we have an interview with him, and that's been used in a documentary by the BBC, I think. Sadly, it was also used for his obituary on Channel 4. So there's a certain amount of commercial use, a lot of academic use. Quite often we get calls or emails from the general public who say, oh, I came across your collection and you've got an interview with my grandfather. That's absolutely wonderful. I'd love to be able to hear it. So quite often the general public come forward and are surprised to find that we've got either an interview perhaps with an old relative or someone talking about them, which is nice.
You talked about a little bit about the management and how we are organized, and it sure is a lot of work. So what is your biggest challenges and how do you solve them working with this project?
Wow. If only we could solve them.
Yeah.
I think the biggest challenge actually is getting enough people to participate in the collection. Of course, that then takes a different kind of management skill, to, you know, it's like herding cats. But one of the challenges is to get enough people being part of the project and actively part and doing things. Otherwise, you know, people come forward saying, I want to interview Joe Bloggs, or quite a few cameramen come forward and say, can we help? Because I think they're not necessarily getting a lot of work these days. And when that's the case, we could go through our list and say, oh, look, top of the list is so-and-so. You could go and interview them. So it is nice to get these cameramen coming forward to help. But then, you know, interviewing can look easy, but it's not always that easy. And not everybody is comfortable interviewing somebody else. So we might have the cameramen volunteering, but then we've got to find someone to to do the actual interview then. Yeah, and then you've got to get them all together in the right place and to make it happen. So the logistics to some extent of doing that is quite difficult. Also, when you're working with a group of volunteers, they can do whatever they think is a good thing to do. It's quite difficult to say, well, actually, we don't need you to do that. But what we really do need is for you to proofread these transcripts, you know.
Yeah.
So it's that sort of inherent problem of dealing with volunteers. And also, you know, we're not that strict or hard line about what needs to be done. You need to play to people's strengths and welcome them, really, and what they can do.
Yeah.
Our biggest worry, I would say, possibly, is the life of the database.
Yeah.
That we really do need funding to be able to upgrade that. That would be essential. But also a concern is the longer term security of the collection. Mm. We've been always moving towards that by getting it all digitized, stored on duplicate hard drives with a database, transcribed and so on. But there's an English expression, if you got run over by a bus tomorrow, you know, what would happen? Yeah. And if a few of us got run over by a bus tomorrow, the collection might be left a bit high and dry. You know, we do have to find some way to partner with an established organization to give it some sort of stability into the next, you know, 10, 20 years or so.
Yeah.
And beyond, of course. But so I think those are our challenges.
You mentioned the importance of being motivated as a volunteer. They have to do what they like to do. What keeps you motivated? You have been working with this for 25 years.
Yeah.
What make you go further and continue the work?
You might well ask. When put it like that, 25 years, I must be, wow. I suppose it's the determination to make the collection safe and accessible. So between us, Mike and I have moved it from, you know, 4 or 5 metal filing cabinets with lots of Sony Walkman cassettes in and no catalogue, just lists of who's been interviewed. So we have moved all that into digital safe content on hard drives. And of course, we use Vimeo and SoundCloud as well. I'd say it's probably 50% have been transcribed now. We have managed to get a lot of publicity for the archive, more people using it and aware of it. But of course, that brings more work and distracts one from, you know, digitizing and transcribing. But in 25 years, I suppose, I can't help it. I'm an archivist and I care about the collection and I really want it to be safe for the future. And it's a pleasurable thing to do. They're nice people you work with. We have a lot in common. We get a sense of achievement when something's, you know, done and done well. And it's better than staying at home watching the television, I suppose, you know, once you're retired. but I hadn't realized it was 25 years. Wow.
Before we wrap up, are there anything you wished I had asked you but failed to do so? And what would you have answered?
No, I think we've covered it. The future plans really are just to try and make it as safe as we can in a well-established home, really. And that's a challenge, finding that home. It's also a challenge finding funding to keep the project going.
Yep.
So many people say, oh, it's a wonderful resource. Oh, it's fantastic. But when you say, okay, then give us £50,000 to sort it all out. Oh, well, that's not quite what I meant. You know, it's so that the funding and the future is the challenge. But you did ask the question anyway, so we'd covered it. Yeah, and the big thing we would love is more volunteers to help us. I was talking to an academic in the States only last week who'd come across the collection and has now volunteered to help us. So we have an interview with someone called Ralph Bond, and this guy would very much like to transcribe that interview for us. So that indicates you can be anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
We'll take anybody's help, basically.
And we have listeners in most continents. So on that note, where can the listeners go to find more information about the project and possibly contact you to do volunteer work?
Yeah, certainly. Well, you can see our website, which is obviously www.historyproject, all one word, www.filmandtelevision.org.uk. And my email is there on the front page, I think, if not very early on. From that website, you can read all about the History Project, and you can access the database by searching by name or free text searching the transcripts, and also search by craft and skill base.
Yes, and I will sure link to this website in the show notes, so it's easy to find for the listeners.
Thank you very much.
Your work is truly important in order to preserve film history, and thanks for all the hours you have spent making this happen. I hope to hear more about your project in the future. I know that some of your colleagues in the Film is Fabulous is coming to Blackpool. I'm not sure if you are going there this time.
Oh, what's the date for that?
The date for this year's Blackpool is Friday the 14th to Sunday the 16th of November 2025 at the Grand Hotel in Blackpool.
November. Oh, well, it might have got a bit cold in Greece by then, so I might come back for that.
If you go there, I would love to see you there.
Yeah, I'll be talking to John and Justin about it, but it'd be lovely to see you there, yeah.
For more information about the Blackpool Film Collectors Convention, you can visit their website at blackpoolfilmconvention.co.uk. You can find the link to the website in the show notes. And perhaps I'll see a few of the listeners there as well. If you enjoyed this episode and want to follow us, you can listen to us and subscribe to our podcast using players like Pocket Casts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and YouTube. You can also use any podcast player supporting RSS. Go to our website, hemmingprojector.com, to learn how to subscribe. You can also listen to any current and previous episodes on our website without any additional software. If you have any feedback for this episode or a suggestion for a future episode, please send an email to feedback@hemmingprojector.com. Huge thanks to you, Sue, for talking about the British Entertainment History Project. I have learned a lot through this recording. And with that, we have reached the end of this podcast. My name is Eivind Mork, and thanks for listening.